Well, I've enjoyed reading some of your papers.
Thank you. Right. Now, because we are coming towards Tisha B'Av, this is a discourse which relates to Tisha B'Av. Next Tuesday will be the 9th of Av, which is a day which commemorates the destruction both of the First Temple and of the Second, and many other tragedies in our history. And this discourse was said by the late Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1964, and it was on Shabbat of the Sedra of this week, Devarim, and that Shabbat would have been the 9th of Av. But because it's the 9th, because the 9th of Av fell on Shabbat, the Shabbat was, the Shabbat pushes off the 9th of Av, so the fast begins on Saturday night and it goes on to Sunday. So that's called Nidche. The fast was pushed off. And the discourse, like many of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's teachings, focuses on a discourse which was said many years earlier by the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, and that was also a discourse which was said on a day when the 9th of Av was pushed off. So there's some aspect of this, displacement of the 9th of Av. There's actually a fascinating statement in the Talmud, which this doesn't quote over here. Kiven de idchi, since it's pushed off, it should be pushed off. There's almost a suggestion, since the 9th of Av was displaced by Shabbat, let's not fast at all. But in the end, they don't accept that opinion, and they do fast. But it gives some idea of the kind of the displacement of this day, which represents dark sorrow, with the idea that the dark sorrow is going to be transformed into the radiance of redemption. And so what this discourse, what this teaching is actually about, is about redemption. It's about the concept of redemption in the sense of a dark world which is going to be illuminated, and that cycle of darkness and light is the theme of the discourse. Darkness representing exile and light representing redemption, and it's going to explore this theme. So it begins with a verse from the book of Job, and if we just look at chapter 28 verse 3, Kates Sam Lachoshech, he puts an end to darkness. You see that verse 3? Yeah. Kates Sam Lachoshech Olochol Tachlis Huchoike, he searches out every hidden thing, everything which is far away. Every tachlis is like the end, the goal. Like it's, tachlis has entered Yiddish as, what tachlis is there? What's the point? What's the purpose? What's the goal? But it also means goal in sort of more esoteric and spiritual terms. So God seeks out all, every end to the very furthest. Evan Eiffel B'Tzalmoves, the stone of darkness and the shadow of death. So very powerful sentences in the book of Job, these very powerful verses. And so that's the phrase. Kate Samla Choshech, he puts an end to darkness, with which our discourse is going to begin. And in typical Midrashic style, you see these Hasidic discourses actually follow a Midrashic structure, going back to the way that a certain kind of midrash, like Vayikra Rabbah, Leviticus Rabbah, would start off with a quotation from the hagiography, from Ktuvim, something like that, from the writings, and then go on a sort of a long meander, and then finally come back to that at the end. You know, so it's this idea of quoting a verse and going round, and then coming back and exploring the whole theme. And at the same time, these discourses have a profound philosophical dimension, as indeed the Midrash itself does have. You know, the Midrash itself has tremendous force. So in order to try to enter the world of the discourse, we will start with the melody of the discourse, which is one of the melodies that we played at this conference last week. And oh, ya, 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 ram, bam, bam, bom. Oh, you rum, but yo, yo, boom. Oh, ya, 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 bam, 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 boom. Oh, ya, ya, bam, boom, bam, bam, boom. Oh, I'm going too high. Go and you sing, I can. When a bar mitzvah boy says his discourse, this melody is often sung as well as an introduction to it. Okay, so here we are in the discourse. Kate Som Lachoshech, God puts an end to darkness. Va'ita v'midrash, and it says in the midrash, Zman natan la'olam kama shanim yaseh ba'afela. God gave a time to the world, how many years it should act in darkness, it should run in darkness. So in other words, the way the Midrash is taking it, that there is an end to the darkness. God made the world function in darkness, in chaos, in confusion. And there's this beautiful passage in a Hasidic tract, you know, where it says, the world is full of confusion, as it says in the book, The Tree of Life, by Reb Chaim Vital, and it gives a chapter and a paragraph, you know, which says the world's very confused, so you wouldn't know otherwise. This is a deep esoteric truth which is hidden in some Kabbalistic manuscript. But there is this world of confusion, of darkness, and God put an end to the time, how long that darkness will go on. In other words, that ultimately there is a time when the confusion will come to an end, and instead of darkness there'll be radiance. Umavai HaTzemach Tzedek, and the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Nachum Mendel, the Tzemach Tzedek, lived around 1850, explains, this is similar to what it says in the Zohar, the Pasuk, L'chol Zman Ve'et L'chol Chefetz. There is a time for everything, which has entered the English language as a saying. There is a moment for everything in life. And it gives there a whole lot of, there's a time to cry and a time to laugh, these pairs. Very beautiful passage. In this verse in Kohelet, that there is a time both for the positive, joyful mode, and also for what the seemingly negative, sorrowful mode. But what the Zohar says there, sheyesh man katzuv lechoshech hagalut, there is a fixed time for the darkness of exile. So in other words, although there is a time for exile, there is a fixed time, and then that time comes to an end. And we have to understand this. Since everything in the world has got a fixed time, Lachol Zman emphasized, everything has a time. What's so special about saying that there is an end put to darkness? Surely, Everything has a time, and there's a time when it functions, there is darkness, then comes an end. What is special about saying, Ketzam Lachoshech, he puts an end to darkness? Now, at the very end of the discourse, he reverses this idea. It doesn't mean that there's an end to darkness now. There's an end to darkness on the very highest level. That the darkness is given some kind of quality of finitude right at the very beginning. Because otherwise, in some sense, the darkness could be something which just would be you couldn't catch hold of it, because it would just continue. And so in order to make it finite, there has to be an end right at the beginning. Now, this may connect to a very interesting idea that there is in Hasidic thought, the demonstration that the universe is finite. How can you demonstrate that the universe is finite? Right? Okay, so you look out at the Milky Way, and there are many galaxies, and who knows how many universes and black holes and whatever it might be. Modern astronomers, I think, do say that there is a sort of a finite level to the universe, you know, except that that's the universe as we know it, you know, and then there might be n-dimensional universes. But there is a concept of the physical universe as we see it being finite. The proof for that... Hi, how are you? The proof for that being that this little bit of the universe, for example, this pencil, is finite. You can measure it. It's, I don't know, 14 centimeters long. So the fact that this little bit of the universe is finite means the whole universe is finite. Because if the universe were infinite, everything would be infinite. Nothing would actually have a finite measure. So as indeed in mathematics, the how many points in a line? Now, the line could be a million miles long, or it could be 1 centimeter long. But there's an infinite number of points in each segment of a line, as well as in a line. You can never talk about a finite number of points in a line. It's always an infinite number of points in a line, because there is an infinity of points in a line. So it makes a difference if it's a big line or a little. So the fact that one little bit of the universe can actually be measured indicates a certain quality of finitude about the whole universe. Now, that may connect with this theme that there is darkness, but the darkness, it's a darkness of limitation, but in that darkness of limitation, there is actually Ketzam Lachoshech, there is actually an end, and the end is not only an end at the end of the darkness, with the beginning of the redemption, it's also an end at the beginning. So right at the beginning, there is a point beyond that darkness. That the darkness is only one way of looking at the world, and there's always another way of looking at the world. I mean, as we have this Lurianic picture of existence, where we have so there's the sense of the infinite radiance beyond, and then what Rabbi Isaac Luria called Tzimtzum, and that signifies a veiling, contraction, a hiding. Hi David, how are you? That's a so that is a veiling, a contraction, and then we have levels of existence below that. And so here we have the sort of the finite worlds coming down here. Yeah, just begun, basically. Yeah. In the first line. So the darkness, in a sense, is this darkness, this realm of concealment. But there is a point beyond, in terms of which that darkness has no power whatsoever. So if we consider what the end of the discourse is saying, that the fact that the darkness actually has an end over here, Keit Sam Lachosha, and that there is the radiance which is higher than the Tzimtzum, than this concealment, from the point of view of that radiance, there never is any darkness. And so therefore there is always a point, there is always a perspective, which is beyond exile. And I think that's that's a central concept in Hasidic thinking in general. What Chabad does is give vocabulary to that concept. But it's there as a basic way that the Baal Shem Tov looks at the world, and it's this redemptive, illuminating quality that the Baal Shem Tov brings to life, that there is a redeemed world, that the exile is but the, as he put it, it's like the shell of a snail. The symptom itself, concealment, is like the shell of a snail. In other words, it is a part of revelation. It is a part of revelation, and that in order to have this infinite revelation, which we are really experiencing, if we only understood it in that way, concealment is part of the story, and our task is to go. Is to be able to see it in that way, and once we see it in that way, it's a different picture. The darkness is actually a corridor leading to light, or light itself.
It just reminds me of like the sort of Kabbalistic interpretation of like the beginning of the Torah. So, you know, the fact that it starts with Bereishit, so you've got the Bet instead of the Aleph to start off Torah, and the fact that like the shape of the Bet, you know, the little chipchick at the side, like, you know, it's meant to be kind of like letting you know that there is this kind of infinite beyond, you know, that as in beyond even beginning of the Torah, there is like, you know, Hashem, there's the light. You know, and then obviously the whole first few lines, Bereishit, are talking about the light. And then that made me kind of think here, maybe it's not the same actually. No, it's not. But like, when you've got the Et, you know, also, isn't it? Because in the beginning, Bereishit, I can't remember how it goes. But like, you've got the et, the aleph tet, which is like a non-word, but kind of the summation of all.
Existence. Right, aleph to top, the whole of. Right, all the letters of existence. Bereishit, bara,
and so in the same way, so everything, everything's sort of contained within that. But yet, beyond that containment, there is. So you've got the Tzimtzum, which is everything which is contained within the Aleph Tet, but the point is there is beyond that.
Like Rav Yitzchak Luria said, there's the white space between the letters. You have the black letters which are communicating the Torah, and then you have the white space between them, so you have this radiant dimension. So there's all the time that balancing of being Yesh, existence, and Ayin, which is beyond existence. And even the word Bereishit can be understood as, it says about wisdom. Wisdom is the beginning of God's Vav Hayim. Let me give you a text. Do you want to see it right here? Does he want a text?
I think
he knows it by heart. He's heard it before.
Right, okay. Okay, so we're fourth line down.
Sorry.
In the middle of the line, over Yoise in the Muvan, And even more is not understood. Dumiloshoina katov keit samla choshech. From the expression of the verse, he puts an end to darkness. Now that implies, mashma, from that implies, sorry, shahachoshech mitzad atzmo ein loket. The darkness in itself does not have an end. Elusha sam loket. He gave an end to it, that God somehow transmitted an end to the darkness. So that's the that's this quality of a kind of boundless, a sense of a boundless darkness, which God is transforming by giving an end to the darkness. So which it actually comes back to at the end of the story, and which I've just been speaking about a little, about putting the end at the beginning, that it's actually the end is there. That's really what the discourse is referring to, this putting at the end at the beginning, that the darkness could be unlimited, but it's not. And the fact that it's not means the whole way of looking at the world. It's very interesting, this possibility of this unlimited darkness, which is negated. Now, v'yeshlo mahabir b'zeh, one can suggest the explanation of this. Zeh shahadvorim abilti ratzurim einin imtsoim b'yud dalet ha'itim. The fact that there are negative things which are not there in the 14 times shenikzavu l'tova, is which are fixed for good. Now that's in the book of Kohelet, where it speaks about a time to be mirthful, a time to be happy, in different aspects of good. It's just that they are not actually there. When a person is happy, it's not that sadness doesn't exist. When a person is laughing, it's not that weeping doesn't exist. It is that it's just not actively there. Because of the good things which are there, the fact that the person is laughing, the things which are negative are invisible, as it were. But it's not that they don't exist. See, there's negativity and there's a positive dimension, and we're talking about what is real, and they are in fact all real. Similarly with light and darkness. Shaha'or doche et ha'choshech. Light pushes away darkness. Now there's a famous verse, not verse, there's a famous phrase which it mentions in the brackets. Ma'at'or doche ha'bechoshech. A little bit of light pushes away a lot of darkness. Now, so in other words, you have a room which is dark, and you light a match, and the little bit of light from the match pushes away the darkness of the room. Now, what is actually happening? You know, is darkness real? In this discourse, it's almost as if darkness is real. There are other discourses in Hasidic teaching where darkness doesn't have any reality whatsoever, where the strong emphasis is that the only reality is light, and you can talk about an absence of light, and the absence of light makes the appearance of darkness like a shadow, but there isn't any reality there. Whereas here, in this discourse, there's a sense in which it's got a more Kabbalistic theme. You see the Hasidic theme, there's the Hasidic focus and the Kabbalistic focus. The Kabbalistic focus very often seems to give room that there is darkness, but here we're talking about somehow getting rid of darkness. So you can have the idea that darkness is pushed aside somehow or other. Darkness is pushed aside. The inyan keit sam lachoshechu, and the idea of putting an end to darkness, that after the end, lo yeshayach klal inin achoshech, darkness will not be a possibility. So that means there's a point where darkness is utterly transcended. It has no role whatsoever. Now, of course, you can interpret this interplay of light and darkness in personal terms. A person can read this whole thing into their own inner life. And in a sort of a general global sense of redemption, of exile and redemption. You see, there's the exile of the Jewish people and the redemption of the Jewish people, which can be seen nationally, or it can be seen globally, because the fact that the Jewish people are in exile means that the people in China are also in exile. And the fact that there is suffering somewhere in the world is because of this state of exile in which the world finds itself. And the Jews are chauvinistic enough to see ourselves that we are somehow at the focus of the whole interplay of exile and redemption. You can actually see the project of modernity in art and music as leading to the realization of exile and that sense of exile, of inner exile, of global exile, of universal exile.
How do you mean?
Yeah.
Well, even Marx talks about exile. You know, Marx's solution for exile is slightly different to the.
No, but you said the modernity in art, and what do you mean by that?
The process of seeing existence as itself a kind of a limitation of infinity, and therefore something very painful, something which is filled with angst, with
expressionism.
You know, the whole expressionism, the whole existentialist way of looking at life, and sort of the pain which is at the very essence of being, as it were. You know, this sense, or as Adorno puts it, you know, the last Beethoven quartets, as opposed to his middle range, you know, Peace with the World. Production, but that's so this sense of the clash that there is in existence, that existence is in a state of pain, and that pain is exile, and the Jewish people see that pain, the Torah sees that pain as revolving around the city of Jerusalem, the Jewish people, our own relationship with God and the Torah, and the quest to restore the temple in Jerusalem and thereby transform history for every human being and transform the nature of life and the nature of existence. So there is this sense of a darkness which is going to be transformed. So the last two lines of this paragraph, the idea that the future redemption will be an eternal redemption, which will not be followed by exile, because then the darkness of exile will not be possible. It'll be beyond that. Now, so what it's moving towards is the idea spelled out in the next paragraph, I think, that you have exile, a cycle of exile and redemption. There's a state of exile, then comes redemption. Wonderful, illuminated, beautiful, everything is good, and suddenly, oy vey, we're back in exile again, for some reason, you know, we didn't do the right thing, or whatever it was. So there is this cycle of exile and redemption. And the question is, and that's a way of looking at Jewish history, you know, it's we've always been through these downs and ups. Can we break out of this cycle? Is that what we are doomed to? Is that really the nature of life? It's a kind of a secularizing way of looking at Jewish history. Yes, well, you know, of course there are periods of pain and suffering, and then everything goes all right again for a while. And that's just what life is like. There's no point protesting about it. But Jewish teaching says, no, that's not what we want. There is a cycle of exile and redemption, but we want a real redemption. We want a transformation so that the world as a whole is on a higher plane and people live in a different way, in a way which is not deraciné, is not uprooted from their inner essence, connects with God and for every human being. So let's have a look in chapter 2, paragraph 2. But v'hine ha'chiluk ba'ofen bitul ha'choshech, the difference in the mode of nullifying the darkness. Im hu rak nidche mipnei ha'or, whether it's just pushed away because of the light, or she'ein shayach klal metziyuto, or its existence is not possible. Notice this word nidche, like Tisha B'Av, nidche, the ninth of Av pushed away. You know, so there's like the darkness and the light. So there's the light pushing away the darkness, and then there's the light overpowering the darkness to such an extent that there's no darkness at all. Now, so that question about the relationship with darkness and of pushing away the darkness, is it a temporary pushing it away, or is it absolutely transcending the whole idea of darkness? Middle of the second line, talui bedargat ha'or, depends on the level of the light. Shebichdei litchot et ha'choshech, in order to push away the darkness, but even after it's been pushed away, it does actually still exist. That would also happen through a limited light. So we could talk about light on this lower level, after the Tzimtzum. And even then, we could still say a little bit of light pushes away a lot of darkness. So a limited form of light still has the power to push away darkness. But the problem is, it doesn't push it away forever. It's a temporary pushing away. In order for the darkness to be completely dissolved, deconstructed, what kind of word would we use in order to say that darkness is no longer a negative or problematic thing, that the darkness changes its whole nature and the way in which you look at it, in fact, whatever it is, it's
transformed.
Yes, it's completely transformed, but it is in itself, it becomes something else. That's so hu al yedei. In order, hu al yedei or bilti mugbal, is through a radiance which is unlimited. And the paradigm for the radiance which is unlimited, which is actually drawing from the end of the discourse, is the radiance which is higher than the Tzimtzum. So when there's a radiance higher than the Tzimtzum, which is shining, then the darkness is completely transcended, and the darkness doesn't have any negative role in that situation whatsoever. Those qualities which might be seen as dark, in fact, become an aspect of radiance. As it says in the Midrash, the fact that the redemption of going out of Egypt, and similarly the redemption from the exile of Babylon, and other exiles, Ad ha'gu'ula d'la'atid, till we reach the future redemption. Hayta gu'ula sheyesh achareya galut, that redemption from Egypt and similarly from Babylon and the other various redemptions of our history, they were all redemptions which are followed by exile. U'gu'ula ha'atida, but the future redemption, tia gu'ula nitzchit, will be an eternal redemption, she'ein achareya galut, not followed by exile. And the reason for that is who ki agulav yitzir mitzrayim hidugmat or haner. Now in the Midrash doesn't use Kabbalistic language, but the Midrash overtly, but the Midrash uses metaphors which we can translate back into more Kabbalistic language. So the Midrash says that the redemption from Egypt, who dugmat or haner, is like the light of a lamp, of an oil lamp, sheshayach boi kibui, which can be put out. You've got a little oil lamp, burning oil, it's very easy to put the lamp out. Ugula hatida, but the future redemption, he dugmat or hayom, is like daylight, sheein shayach bo kibui, which cannot be put out in the same way. I mean, obviously, in the mashal, you know, so day can turn to night and so on. But if you're just looking at it at that moment, the daylight is, the sun is shining, especially in Israel, and it's not so easy to imagine putting it out, whereas, say, England might have. They might not have thought of this metaphor in England. But comes a cloud. But a lamp, an oil lamp, just a little. You just have to shake the oil lamp, and the flame is sputtered out. So it's very fragile light. So that's the Midrash saying the same sort of thing without using Kabbalistic language, is saying that there is a kind of illumination which is fragile, temporary, and limited, and there's another kind of illumination which is beyond limitation. Right? So that's the Midrash saying it in its own way. V'hainu, that means, over the next page, Chahagilu digu'ula atida, that the revelation of the future redemption, yegilu or bilti mugbal, will be an unlimited radiance, she'en shaykh v'hefzeh, which cannot be interrupted, v'lechein tiegula nitzrit, and therefore it will be an eternal redemption, she'en achrei galut, which will not be followed by exile. So in other words, the cyclic nature of Jewish history will suddenly jump out of the cycle, and it will be a new dimension. One of the metaphors for the redemption is a woman having a baby. And it is a feature of having babies sometimes that the woman goes into labor, and nothing happens. She goes to the hospital, you know, and they say, no, no, not yet, you know, go home. That's she's got a baby inside her, you know, something's going to happen. But it can well be a process of apparent cycles which don't actually lead to redemption, to birth at that moment. And then eventually it does. And she finally has the baby. Thank God. Mazel tov. So, Gimel. Okay, so here we have a concept of breaking out of the cycle of Jewish history. Because the cycle of Jewish history is one of exile followed by redemption, and then the redemption is followed by exile. And we're as if trapped in that cycle. And we are talking about breaking out of that cycle. And you could say that the Lubavitcher Rebbe wanted to achieve that. That's what he wanted to achieve. He could see this cycle right from childhood. And he wanted that the Jewish people and the world should break out of that cycle. And he felt that our generation, the generation after the Holocaust, and all kinds of other factors as well, led to the idea that we can indeed break out of that cycle, and that now we can in fact break out of that cycle. And the way that he wants to help this process take place is through Torah teachings. This Torah teaching that we're studying is itself a mechanism for transforming these interrelations in existence so that we should somehow open the channel to this radiance which is beyond limitation. So now he spells this out a bit in the next paragraph given. V'hine yidua, now it's known, shekol gilui hu al yidei Torah. Every revelation is through Torah. You want to reveal something, it's through Torah. There's a very interesting concept. See, there's an approach to life that before you do something, you learn the Torah rules about it. You sit down with a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch or something like that, the brief code of Jewish law, and you see, now what does the code of law say about this? What does it say about that? We're coming to Tisha B'Av. What does the code of law say about the 9 days and about the fast of Av and how on Monday, what time we have to stop eating and entering the fast, that whole atmosphere. So there's a so you read the Torah rules about it, and then there are further dimensions of Torah. why is it the Torah brings revelation to life? Because of the very phrase about Torah, Torah is light. Torah sheds light on things. Just by learning Torah about something, even if it seems, logically it seems peripheral to the issue, but the fact that we're learning the Torah about it itself is a deeper level of relevance. And from this it's understood, since the getting rid, the deconstruction of the darkness of exile is through light, therefore, in order to draw nearer, to quicken the future redemption, it's by studying Torah about light. So in other words, we're trying to coax this infinite radiance from before the Tzimtzum to come into the world and transform everything in the world so that there's not only no darkness but no possibility of darkness. So in order to coax this light into our world, into our frame of being, we're going to learn something about light. That's basically what the Rebbe is saying. You know, so we're going to talk about light, and we're going to explore light in a Torah, in a Hasidic, Kabbalistic dimension about light. Ulahaya, and one could mention the Drush Admur Murashav Nishmat Eden. There is a discourse by the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, which was said on Shabbat Tisha B'Av, which was pushed off in the year 18, footnote 15 gives this, in the year 1914. So 1914, Tisha B'Av also fell on Shabbat, and on that Shabbat the fast was pushed off, and on that day Rabbi Shalom Dovber, the fifth Rebbe, said a discourse about light. 1914 was one of the last couple of years being in the city of Lubavitch, or the town of Lubavitch. He then left Lubavitch in 1916, went to Rostov. So it was one of the last talks, probably, or not one of the last, but it's the last couple of years of being there in Lubavitch. And in that discourse, he talks about light. Now, the teaching, exploring light, which is going to be in the rest of this discourse, or much of the rest of this discourse, is drawn from Rav Shalom Dovber's discourse. So it's so Rav Shalom Dovber was talking on a day when Tisha B'Av had been pushed off by Shabbat, and this discourse in 1964 was being taught on a day when Tisha B'Av was being pushed off by Shabbat. And he's talking about this radiance, that it shouldn't just be a temporary pushing off, but a permanent pushing off of exile, in order to have a permanent radiance of redemption. The Yesh Lomar, one can say, Shashaychut in Yinzele Tisha B'Av Nitchehu, the relationship of this to Tisha B'Av, which is pushed away, is, Ki Tisha B'Av Shachol B'Shabbat B'Nitchehem, Tisha B'Av, which falls on Shabbat and is pushed off, humasugal lefol sheyia nitche legamre. It's like coming close to the idea of being pushed away completely. And as it says in page footnote 17, he gives a reference to Megillah 5b, where I think it says there that given the itche itche, since the fast was pushed off, let it be pushed off altogether. He doesn't actually quote it, but he gives the reference to it. Ubitula galut, and how do you push away exile? Hu alide or is through light. Okay. So now we're going to explore the concept of light. Now in this exploration, we're going to be looking at this little diagram that I was making in order to try to follow what he was saying. Maybe let's look at the diagram first. You see, you've got the luminary and the light. Ma'or in Hebrew is luminary, the source of the light. And then you have the light, which actually comes from the luminary. And the question over here is the relationship between the light and the luminary. Now, what do we mean by luminary and light? On one level, this is a metaphor. So we can talk about the light coming from the light bulb and the light which is shining down into the room. But on another level, we're talking about God and existence. You see, the central metaphor in the Kabbalah is light. That is the central metaphor, that there's light, and there are vessels for the light, and the vessels for the light are Sfirot. They are the divine Sfirot, and the central image of the Kabbalah with the different positioning of a vessel with radiance within the vessel and a flow of light, a flow of radiance flowing through, which is sometimes called the Ilana Dechaya, the tree of life, the tree of life, the tree of the Sfirot, but it's really the same idea as this flow of radiance flowing through from the infinite, a flow of radiance flowing into the world, into every aspect of the world. So it's as if here we're looking at some kind of relationship within this, that there's the luminary and there is the light, and within the luminary you can talk about the metziut, the being, the presence of the luminary, which is a sort of a more coarse phenomenon. When it says being over here in italics of the luminary, it's a more coarse aspect of the luminary. And higher than that, beyond that, is the essence of the luminary. It's something more profound. And in the same way, when one talks about the light, one can talk about a more superficial aspect of light, like the glow of the light, which is shining, the hitpashtuta of, the spreading out of the light, the glow. And on the other hand, there's the etzem ha'or, there's the very essence of the light. So we have here three kinds of relationship between light and luminary. We've got A, where you've got a connection between the glow, that means the lower level of light, and the being, the metziut, the lower level of the luminary. So that's the first level of relationship. A second level of relationship is B, where in fact the glow goes back to the essence of the luminary. So that's something more profound. And the third level is C, where the essence of the luminary sparks off the essence of the light. So it's the deepest dimension in both ways. These sort of three logical positions, given that you've got the essence and a sort of something secondary. So either the two secondary things connecting, or the secondary and the essence, or both essences connected together. And then underneath, it gives the kind of sort of explanation in Kabbalistic terms of the difference between these three kinds of relationship, A, B, and C. And all this sounds extremely abstract. And there's a sense in which it's something relating to the world of the Sfirot, and in some kind of celestial realm. And on the other hand, it can also be seen as aspects of a person's own relationship with the divine. And he will spell that out, and hopefully we'll be able to reach that and understand it a little bit. So these are really talking about inner processes which are happening inside us as well. And this sense of living life in terms of a reality of being, an essence of being, and with one's own essence. There's this concept in English literature of the persona, you know, the mask. I remember when I first heard about this at school, you know, it's such a real concept that everyone is living behind this mask. And And the problematic thing is not just that their mask is shown to other people, so they are hiding themselves from other people, but their mask is shown to themselves, so they're hiding themselves from their own self. And the whole thrust of Hasidic teaching, all this could be translated into Jewish terms, it's not only in a English literature class, but the thrust of Hasidic teaching is to get beyond the persona, to get beyond the mask, as mezol zich nishnaren, as it says in Yiddish, that one shouldn't fool oneself. And that naren zich, that fooling of oneself, is the the sort of the ongoing pitfall in all aspects of life, including religiosity and being a Torah scholar. There's lots of room to fool oneself, you know. So the whole of early Hasidic literature is really devoted to, if we take a book like Toldos Yaakov Yosef, by the first Hasidic book printed in 1780, it's talking about rabbis who are scholarly and learned, and who think that they are better than the other people around them in the community, because, of course, I'm scholarly and I'm learned, so that must make me better. And what the author, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, is trying to demonstrate is that, in fact, the bad thought in the mind of the rabbi who is praying is in some ways worse than something or other that the man in the market might be doing. It's because this man who is...
he's not fooling himself.
That's like, yeah. Well, yeah, like the...
Yosela the Ganeth. You say to him, who are you? He says, I'm Yosela the Ganeth, the thief. He knows he's a thief, at least.
There's a story about the Kotzke Rebbe, Rebbe Nachum Mendel of Kotz, who lived also around 1850. So when a simple man would come to him, like a Jewish farmer or something, would come to him, so he would let him in immediately and talk to him, and so the chap would go away, all smiles. But if a rabbi, and he had many very learned rabbis who were his followers, the Chidushi Arim, who became the founder of the Gera Chassidim, a great Talmud Chacham, was one of his followers, and he had many other people like that. When one of these rabbinic people would come to him, he would keep them waiting for weeks before he would let them in to see him. And I think it was actually his wife who asked him. She was the sister of the Chidush Arim and had a certain strength to her as well. She said, why do you keep these rabbinic scholars, why do you keep them waiting, you know, so long? And, you know, they just come to the Beis HaMedrash, they sit there learning, waiting and waiting and waiting until the Kotzke Rebbe will let them in to speak to him. He said, look, when the simple man comes and he says, a cow, he means a cow. When the rabbi comes and says, God, he actually means a cow. So I'm keeping him waiting so he should realize what he means, and then we could talk to him. So that, Arot Nemen Denar Van Velt, to take away the folly of the world, starting with oneself, and that is the goal of Hasidic teaching. So in other words, to get to the essence of oneself and the essence of the luminary as well, that when one is learning Torah, you could read it in that way, the luminary is the Torah, you know, so there's the simple fact of the Torah, and then there's deeper and deeper dimensions of the Torah. So somehow or other, the very inward essence of one's own being should reach towards the inner essence of Torah teaching. All right, so let's look at it in this Hebrew paragraph.
Tony, before you move on, can I just ask you about the terms on the diagram?
Yeah.
A, B, C. Just to clarify, so it starts with Bina.
Well, yeah. Bina is the lowest level.
The lowest level, which is understanding.
Right.
Then there's Chochmah.
Which is higher. Bina is a lower understanding, then wisdom. And then beyond that is Keter, is the crown.
In when I was reading the Tanya, there was a reference to the relationship between Bina, Chochmah, and Da'at.
That's going downwards.
That's going
downwards. That's Chochmah, Bina, Da'at. Now, Da'at is a very profound sphere, because Da'at is lower than Chochmah and Bina, but it also reaches above. But what it's doing, it's transforming the inspiration and the contemplation of wisdom and understanding into a form that focuses on our, kicks in to our actual reality. That's the force of Da'at, that it bonds one's cerebral discoveries with one's emotional and practical reality as a person. Now that's going downwards, whereas here, see, it is Keter, which goes beyond. You could make a case, although it doesn't mention it in this discourse, for the Keter level being connected with the Da'at level, because they're both on the middle line. So everything on the middle line is connected. Chochmah is on the right, Chochmah wisdom is on the right, Bina understanding is on the left. Keter is in the middle above, and Da'at is in the middle below, and everything on the middle line connects below. Yeah. Okay. So we're now entering into this discourse, and the idea of entering into this discourse is that we're about light, is that by studying Kabbalistic or Hasidic teaching about radiance, about light, and different dimensions of light, we're actually going to provoke this light from beyond the Tzimtzum to enter the world and transform the exile. There's a story in the Zohar, which the Rebbe would often quote, that they came to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and there was no rain. One second. I can't remember if this story is in the Zohar or it's in the Talmud. I'm sorry. Do you remember? Is it in the Talmud? They came to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and there was no rain. They needed rain. The world needed rain. And he said a Torah teaching about Hinei Matov Umayofa, how beautiful and pleasant it is, Sheves Achim Gam Yachad, of brothers sitting together. There's actually a popular song, Hinei Matov Umayim, Sheves Achim Gam Yachad. How beautiful and pleasant it is, friends sitting together. And he said a Torah teaching on that, and it began raining. So somehow or other, the Torah teaching somehow transformed reality. The Rogatchover was Rabbi Rosin from Rosen from in the late 19th century, a very, very great Torah scholar. The Rogatchover Gaon, he was called. So one day he got a letter from the Russian government, which said that he was liable to pay two kinds of tax. And he said, according to the Torah, the first kind of tax I am liable to pay, but the second kind of tax I'm actually not liable to pay. And a few days later, another letter came. Sorry, we made a mistake. You're only liable to pay the first kind of tax, not the second. So the idea is that he paskened halacha, that made a Torah statement, and that affected what the official in Moscow thought that this rabbi, what tax this rabbi should pay. You know, so there's this interconnection between existence, and especially Torah, and the Jews studying Torah is transforming existence in some way. So we are studying this teaching about light, and that is going to transform the world as we're teaching it. And so it may never be the same again. And it explains in the discourse of the Rebbe Rashab, that means from 1914, the Or Hu Ayin Bittul, the whole idea of light is that light expresses Bittul, selflessness. The Hachiluk Bein Or B'Kli, that's the distinction between the basic paradigm of the Kabbalah, radiance and vessel. Husha ohu ayin is that the radiance is like nothing in a sense. Ukli hu yesh, and the vessel exists. So there's the tangible reality of the vessel and the spiritual beyond reality of the radiance. So wherever you are, at whatever position one is in, one can talk about this dichotomy of radiance and vessel, that the radiance is something which is more ethereal, more spiritual, less tangible, less self, and the vessel is more tangible and is more self. Funnily enough, sometimes the positions reverse, but that, because the radiance itself can become intoxicating and bring out a certain sense of self, which is very, that's another level of Arop Nemendana, you know, removing the foolishness from oneself. But in general, radiance expresses some aspect of selflessness. And when you're talking about the selflessness of radiance, Gimel Madregas, there are three different levels, and those are three different levels I tried to draw in this diagram. Habitul Do'or Mitzavatzmoy. First, there's the selflessness of radiance in itself, mipnesha or huma'ena ma'or, because the radiance is like the luminary, it's shining from the luminary. So that's one level. V'habitl shaboy al yedei shenigah shaboy mekoyra. Then you have another level. Not only that the radiance expresses the luminary, but in the radiance you can feel where it's coming from. That you can feel that this radiance is coming from a holy place. You know, it's not just that there's light and the light is coming from some luminary, but it's that when you see the light, you begin thinking about where it is coming from, and that where it's coming from is drawing you in some way. See, sunlight, we're perfectly happy to enjoy the sunlight without being, as it were, drawn towards the sun. But there are other kinds of illumination where the very fact that there is this sense of illumination is draws. You can feel the source in it. And then there's a third kind of selflessness. V'abitul shaloi mitzad teva harotzo. Because of the thrust of the radiance, v'aliyah shaboy, the radiance tending and longing, so to speak, likalal b'mekoyroi, to be absorbed in its source. Not only do you feel the source in the radiance, but there's a magnetic quality that the radiance itself wants to dissolve in its source, and it's some kind of like a candle flame. So there's the idea that the candle flame, why does the candle flame burn upwards? Because the flame comes from the sphere of fire, which is around the world. And the flame, it comes from that origin, and the flame is seeking its origin. So the flame is seeking to return to the sphere of fire. In the same way, the soul comes from God and is seeking to reconnect with God. So there is always this thrust of the soul upwards towards the divine. Now we have to understand harigam abitul d'or shmitzad atzmoi. When we're talking about the selflessness of the radiance in itself, you'd have thought it's because light doesn't have a tangible existence of its own. The whole point of light is to make the luminary shine. What's the difference between the first level, the light, she'in yono hugila ma'or, the idea that the light is shining from the luminary, lezeh she'nigash boi b'mekoyroi, to the other kind of light where the source can be felt. In other words, A and B. He wants to explain the difference in the diagram between A and B. Now, you see, the diagram, of course, cheats. because the diagram writes his answer. What is apparent in the diagram is the answer between A and B. Because A, the glow of the light is coming from the being, from the less spiritual dimension of the luminary. And in B, the glow of the light is coming from the essence of the luminary. So in the diagram, the answer of what he's saying is there as two different types of light. And the way in which he begins is at the bottom. A, the light which reveals the luminary, and B, the light in which its source is felt. So he has presented it the other way around. Do you understand what I'm saying? But what's written at the bottom, he has made the tangible thing that he's discussing. And then he's saying, what's the difference between them? And then it comes out what's in the diagram. But to me, I was taken by the diagram, the idea that there are these different dimensions of light, and then you can speak about them in different ways.
Can I just ask, is it useful to understand the diagram in a simple way as like the sun and the moon? That the luminary is the sun, and the light is the moon. Just explain it in a simple way for somebody like me.
Well, I'm not sure if in that model the moon is subtle enough to... Because how do you make the difference between the glow and the essence for the moon?
Yeah, I understand it. But basically what's happening here between the luminary and the light is the luminary is lighting up the light.
Yeah, absolutely. The luminary is lighting up the light. There's a light which is shining from the luminary.
Then you've got two different things. You've got the essence and the border.
Yes.
Of the luminary of the sun, and the essence and the border of the moon.
Yes. Yes.
And you've got this A, B, and C.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You can do it that way. Yeah. In fact, it works better if you would say the luminary is the teacher and the light is the pupil or something like that, because then you've got more subtlety about what we mean by essence and glow and so on. See, the physical sun and moon, the whole idea of the essence, you know, perhaps you can speak about the essence of the light, but it's what exactly is meant. If you speak about the spherot, where you're anyway talking about a metaphysical reality. So, of course, there are many dimensions in a metaphysical reality, and so you can talk about the glow or the essence, you can talk about different levels. The whole perspective of Kabbalistic thought is seeing many levels where previously, apparently, there was just one thing. In fact, it's a multidimensional structure. I mean, that's the whole way in which Kabbalistic teaching looks at existence, with the famous phrase from the Zohar that the world is like an onion. Now, an onion is shells which are within each other. And you've got one level is a shell to the next level. And that level, that inner level, is moach, is the inwardness to the outer level. But that level which is inwardness in relation to that first level of outer shell, that itself becomes a shell in relation to a yet further level. So there's always another level and another level. So and that's the nature of existence. And that can lead to the need for a relativistic perspective, in the sense, even though we're dealing in terms of absolute Torah teachings, but nonetheless, there are situations where the same action done by two different people may signify two completely different things. So it's like vectors, you know, it's not only a number, but it's a direction as well. And so that question is... So where a person is and what they're doing, it's much more subtle an analysis if you're looking at it in this sort of multiple view. It's Hasidic teachings which take this aspect of the Kabbalah and bring it out to its most powerful fruition and social application. So that's the okay. So let's go to the next paragraph. Well, I tell you what. What he comes out with is our diagram. In the Hebrew, it's like takes quite a long time to go through it. But what he's going through is that there are different dimensions of light, and they connect the radiance and the luminary on different dimensions, and our diagram enables us to make a sort of a shortcut through this teaching, which is actually him telling over the teaching of Rav Shalom Dov there from 1914, right? So it's a teaching within a teaching. And he explains it in terms, let's just look at what it says at the bottom, because this is about 4 or 5 paragraphs of the actual discourse. So if we just look at the wording at the bottom. A, B, and C. A is the light which reveals the luminary. Let's just read the first bit of the defining of A. A, the light which reveals the luminary. B, the light in which its source is felt. C, the light which seeks to be absorbed in its source. Okay, so that's a distinction between A, B, and C. In other words, light which just shines from the light bulb, nothing more. Light in which the source is felt, B, it's a different kind of light where you can feel it's coming from somewhere special. And C, not only is it coming from somewhere special, it's drawing you back into that, you know, you're hypnotized by the light. It's drawing you back to the essence, to the beyond. All right. Now let's read the next phrase. The light which is in the vessel. You see, in the Kabbalah, you've got radiance and vessels. So the ordinary simple light of the Sfirot is the light which is in the vessel. You've got the Sfira Chesed, the vessel of kindness, and within kindness there's a radiance. B is a light which is outside the vessel. It's too exalted to be in the vessel. It's a finite radiance which is in the vessel. But this is a more exalted kind of light, so it doesn't fit in the vessel. It's beyond the vessel, like an idea. An idea which you're grappling, there's a simple idea, which you can phrase in words. So it's light in the vessel of the words. Then you've got an idea which is more complicated. You can't actually express it. It's too deep to express, and so the light is beyond the vessel. But then C, the light which is beyond any talk of vessel. It's so much beyond vessel, you can't imagine a vessel. It's something so much beyond words, it's ineffable to the highest degree. You just wouldn't imagine being able to put this into words. It's a different kind of, a different dimension of communication, and maybe beyond communication altogether. So there's a higher level of radiance. And then he connects that with the Sfirot as well. Bina, Chochma, and Keter, beyond. Okay, so that's sort of a glimpse, a very superficial glimpse, of the teaching about radiance. And if we then go on to paragraph He, that's on page Kuf Nun He, it's a little paragraph He, 4 lines long. Vehine Gimel Madregas Haniskala Eil. Now these 3 levels. Yeah, you have it? Paragraph Hey. It's a little paragraph. And it's harder because these are printed on the back by our wonderful photocopier. Right. Behine gil madregas. Now these 3 levels, ba bitl d'or, of the selflessness of the light, yesh tugmosam, there's something similar about them, gam ba'avodata adam, also in the service of a person to God. Va'al pi ha'muvala el, and as we explained above, meha maima, quoting the discourse of Rav Shalom Dober of 1914, shagimu madregas anal ba'bitul da'or, these three levels of the selflessness of the light, heim bebina chochma keter, therein understanding, wisdom, and keter. So from that, yesh mama, you could suggest, shagimu biturim hanal, that these three levels of selflessness, ba'avodata adam, in the service of a person to God, Haim, now, let's see what it is. Habitul dahasaga hamyusedet alimuna. The mind, the rational mind based on faith. Habitul demuna. Then the selflessness of faith without rationality, beyond rationality. And finally, habitul de mesirat nefesh. The selflessness of complete surrender, self-sacrifice, in some sense, whatever that might be. Now,
nefesh there means what exactly?
Well, mesirut nefesh, self-sacrifice, or sacrifice of the self, or of the soul, or of the will. See, mesirut nefesh can be self-sacrifice, like Jews dying al Kiddush Hashem in 1096. But also, it could be someone saying the Shema with a total self-surrender. Or it can be someone who forgot to bring their sandwiches and they're going on a long train journey and the train restaurant only serves non-kosher food, so they don't eat for 7 hours traveling to Glasgow or somewhere. And that's also something. so there are different dimensions of self-sacrifice, you know, different varieties of it. My doctorate was actually about self-sacrifice in Hasidic teaching. So speaking about different types of self-sacrifice and the way in which Hasidic thought interprets self-sacrifice in different, completely different ways. Which is like a well-known topic in Jewish history. Now, for Yuvanzer, so this idea of intellect, I think we're going to try in the few minutes remaining, we'll try a...
Forgive me if I disappear.
Yes, by all means. Thank you. Sure. Now, you have intellect, rationality, you have faith, emunah, and also self-surrender, self-sacrifice. So there are those three levels. Now those three levels represent the three levels A, B, and C. There's rationality, informed by faith. Then there's faith. Now, in an article that I wrote about this discourse, this intrigued me very much, this relationship between faith and rationality. Because there's a rationality which is informed by faith, and then there's faith beyond the rationality, and then there's self-sacrifice beyond that. So, let's just read a little bit of this.
Tell us where you are.
Yes. I think let's go into the next page, Kuf Nun Vav. Four lines down, Ubehitlavshut. The line begins Ubehitlavshut. You have that?
Yeah.
Right. Ubehitlavshut emunah b'seichel, in the enclosing of faith in rationality, The fact that the rational mind comes to the conclusion that that thing in which he believes, who emet, is true, gam mitzad haseichel, also from the point of view of reason, hu mitzad haseichel, is because of reason itself. So in other words, you've got an interaction between faith and rationality, and the rationality is exploring a dimension which is opened up by faith, and it comes to the conclusion that the faith is true. However, the way that it comes to that conclusion is not by suppressing itself, but by acting as reason. Now, let's just take the brackets. Because mitbonen b'sichlo, because when he thinks, he cogitates with his mind, b'chdei shegam ha-seichel shelo, in order that also his mind, his rational mind, yir kafi ha-emet, should be on the path of truth, hu mishtadel sheitbonenut, he tries that his thinking, v'hashak levatariya shelo, and the rational discussion that he has, yiyu al pi amitit ha-seichel, should be within the real terms of his rational mind. In other words, he doesn't retreat from his rationality. He is actually within the context of his rational mind. He is trying to get to the very essence of this rational mind, and yet what he is discovering is faith. Now, there's a very interesting footnote, footnote 33. Let's just have a look. Footnote 33. Umipnei sheyodea, and because he knows, shahadavar be'etzem hu emet, that the thing that he's thinking about is true, al pi yusod emunah chazaka, because of the basis of strong faith, shebo, which he has, einu yared lenafsho, he's not frightened, lahamik b'zeh b'yoter, to think more deeply about this, ve'einu magbil et koach sichlo, and he doesn't limit the power of his mind, la'ayin ulechapes v'lishkol kol davar, to analyze and to search and to weigh each thing, ad shiyavo alamitit hadavar, until he comes to the very truth of that thing. Now, I regard this as an absolutely fascinating statement in the interaction between rationalism and faith and tradition. Because our normal concept of this relationship is that the rational mind has to sort of blinker itself in some way. It can't cope with the dangers of thinking. You know, what happens if he thinks? You know, he'll start thinking this, he'll start thinking that, he'll end up not believing. That's the typical model. And what it's saying here is that somehow, if there is a healthy relationship which is internalized, and this is really, I mean, I must say, you know, in my understanding of Jewish society, this is the Chabad contribution to Yiddishkeit, to Orthodoxy, that if a person has the right kind of relationship between faith and rationality, they don't have to be afraid what their rational mind is going to discover, because it's on a clear highway. And yes, there are all kinds of bumps and pitfalls and so on, but you can find that in Hasidic teaching as well. You know, you might find this darkness, but you know, the darkness is there in the Torah. Yes, that's all part of it. That's all part of it. There's nothing to be frightened of.
So it's the ability to think out of the box, but actually out of the rational box, particularly.
Yes, well, that's a further dimension, I think. That the ability to think out of the rational box is when you make the next step beyond, and even the next step beyond. So these are metaphors of thinking, and those are the A, B, and C of the three different types of light, where you're getting closer and closer to the essence of the light, relating to the essence of oneself. And so these three dimensions of being, these three modes of being, are in fact the freedom of the person who is expressing this Torah teaching and at this level. And I think it's a very beautiful and powerful image. And what it's being used for here is to express the relationship, if we go back to the beginning of the story, the relationship between the light of freedom and of redemption versus the darkness of exile. So it's somehow or other this process of a deeper kind of transformation of one's own inner rationality, where one discovers that rationality as an expression of faith. It doesn't become, it's not a conflicting thing, it's the expression of faith. It's like, you know, maybe you could compare physicality within marriage is the expression of love. It's not a contrary to the spiritual love between the people, it's the expression of the spiritual love. So there is this this picture here, and then if we move on to the end, so if we go to Tet, right at the end, page Kuf Nun Chet, penultimate page, Tet. So now we've come back to the whole question of light illuminating the world, and having launched into this exploration of light and the translation of it into our own personal relationship with God. Now, but tzarich lavin, we have to understand the lechoira at first sight, kiven shemitzada or the lehoi tzaolamoy, since as regards the light which is illuminating the world, iyefshar shiyispat lechoshech. In terms of the ordinary process of light, how can the darkness go away completely? V'rak shenitche mipnei ha'or, it's just pushed away before the light. And the fact that in the ultimate redemption the darkness of exile will really be nullified, it's because then there will be the revelation of a new radiance above all relationship to worlds. Now here comes, so in other words, go back to the previous picture, the infinite radiance from before the Tzimtzum, that's the radiance which is going to transform the world and bring the redemption. And then he asks the most intriguing question. Harei Olam Atzmai, this brings us on to the very last page. Now the world itself, K'moishahu mitzad ha'gadorim shaloi, as the world is in its limited way, Yehnisha begolos chas v'shonim, might remain in exile. You see, you can have such a beautiful illumination, but it only affects very spiritual people, or the very spiritual dimension of people. And the world itself is left in darkness. You know, it's almost as if you could have the redemption, but God forbid the redemption could miss the world, because it's happening in another dimension. It's in too ethereal a dimension. So the question is, how are we going to make sure that this illumination actually gets into the world as a world? Yes, world qua world. That's me. That's the thing. And it doesn't just remain in a Hasidic text. Unukudus abir b'zeh, and the basic explanation of this, the matamim al zeh shabriya, the fact that in creation, Hoysa ba'oifen shebetchila was in such a way that at the beginning nimtza ha'or, there was light shelamayla mishaychut la'olamot, which was above any connection with worlds. Our whole concept of creation is that there is this radiance beyond the worlds. Umimenu dafka nimshach ha'or de'lahoyes ha'olamos. From this radiance before the tzimtzum comes the light which does ultimately illuminate and create the worlds. It's that in order that the radiance which comes in and gives life to the world, will have in it, at least concealed, will have in it something of this hidden radiance. So in other words, within existence itself, there is implanted the breath of redemption. That all the way down the line, there is the breath of redemption as well, the illumination of redemption. And so therefore, Val Pizemuvan, through this we can understand, Shahagam Shabitl Achoshech Hagalot, even though the eradication of the darkness of exile will be through revealing the essence of the light, which is from beyond, nonetheless, Tiyeh HaGu'ulah, the redemption will be Gam B'Gidrei HaOlam, also within the limitations of the world itself. In other words, the whole idea of redemption is entering the world of limitations, is entering the realm of limitations. That is where redemption has to take place. Because if we withdraw from the limitations, if we try to sort of abstract ourselves from reality and just be in some sort of spiritual plane, if we all get high, great. You know, on spiritual terms, you get high on a mimer, you can get high on a piece of Torah teaching, and you get high, wonderful. So you're redeemed. Now that's very beautiful. But the point is that the redemption should come into the nitty gritty of the world. And from what the Rebbe is teaching here, it's built into the world that that is possible. That within the very finitude of existence is also the infinite radiance of redemption. And then that leads into the very last paragraph, where he says, what does it mean, Kate Samba Lachoshech, he put an end to darkness. It means right at the beginning, there is that idea that the darkness does not, it's not an untrammeled thing which cannot be redeemed at any point. God put right at the beginning an end. There is a finitude to the darkness, meaning the possibility and the eventuality of redemption. And so therefore redemption is built into the system right at the very beginning.
So it's like the prosaic, like the everyday being transformed into the infinite.
Absolutely. Yes.
So that's the transformation where it comes in.
Yes. And I mean, you can say that through Torah mitzvot that we're carrying out in our daily lives, the ordinary everyday world, where what we eat and what we wear and what we do is all an expression of this infinite transformation of existence. And that is drawing this radiance into the finite world and revealing a world which is...
So the point is, if you're just sunbathing, so to speak, the light's coming from somewhere else, you're not really transforming the world. Whereas if the light is sort of coming and transforming the darkness into light,
yes,
you're actually transforming the world,
yes,
so
yes,
to speak.
I mean, I would read that. You see, there's a way of relating instead to of Torah and Judaism in a way of sunbathing, like you put that image.
Instead of being something external, it becomes internalized, so to speak.
But it's the mundane being transformed into the esoteric as well.
Well, that's the interesting thing. Is the esoteric secret, or is it reality? And that's the... There was once, the Rebbe began teaching little Torah passages for children. And eventually there were 12 Torah passages. And sometimes when there's a children's gathering, they recite these Torah passages. So he'd begun teaching these, and he taught 6 of them. And I produced a little leaflet with these. I got a friend who was a scribe who wrote them out nicely in Hebrew and nicely written in English as well. And I called it Torah Secrets. So this was shown to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe said, why secret? It's not a secret, you know, like this undoing of the esoteric, you know, there's a certain lust for the esoteric, but no, like, open the door, it's not esoteric at all, it's the real.
Yeah.
But the point is, they're the same.
Sorry?
The point is, surely they're the same.
Well, they're the same, but how do we look at them? Is it secret which is hidden?
Well, we don't have to look at it in any way. It's a fact, like, you know, the point is that when we start, you know, if it were to become a reality, you're not looking at it in any way. It just becomes reality. You know, the esoteric is no longer, because the gap is no longer apparent. The gap, you know, the two things are connected. That's the whole point of transformation. You know, so.
Right, but there's also the way that we ourselves look at it. You see, there is a sense in which the esoteric is self-aggrandizing.
Nobody else knows, that's why.
But it is only when you're looking from, you know, below up. If something has entered, you know, in an internalization, an internalized kind of way, then it's no longer, it no longer has that quality, you know, because it's not something that you're kind of aspiring towards or like seeing as beyond, you know, you're seeing it as very real and tangible, and the only way you feel that, the reality of that, is in the practicality of what you're doing, because that's where, you know, that's its medium, as it were.
Mm.
So it becomes internalised.
Yeah, and it's that internalisation which
is
the revelation of the esoteric. Yeah.
In simple terms, so I think of it in terms of a holiday, that instead of being in London in the dark and the rain and hating it, and came for 2 weeks to Mallorca so that you can survive another 50 weeks in the dark and the rain of London, somehow London is transformed and you enjoy being in London so much, you say, what do I need to go to Mallorca for? It's boring. You know, in my own simple way.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay, I think that's a good...
Yeah, I like that.
I don't know if it's right or wrong, but everybody can understand
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Could you relate some of the material in this last paragraph that we've gone through here to the language, say, in the Havdalah service, the distinction between the sacred and the profane?
Right. Now, there's a very interesting issue in Jewish thought, which is that while on the one hand the borders between dark and light, sacred and profane, are being deconstructed and dissolved, simultaneously they are there as well. And so there remains a distinction between Shabbat and the weekday, and Jew and non-Jew for that matter, that everything is significant, and yet it's significant in its own way, and there is a distinction between. So there is an approach to Jewish thought, let's say Martin Buber's approach, who takes the idea from Hasidism, that Hasidism is deconstructing borders, and therefore all borders are to be deconstructed, and there are no borders. and that leads away from halachic Judaism and dissolves it. And on the other hand, what I've managed to cook up with the help of some postmodernist philosophers and thinkers is that the very nature of the postmodern is that it will admit to contrary qualities at the same time. So on one hand you are dissolving borders between the profane and the sacred, and on the other hand, like in an architecturally postmodern building, you look at one part of it and it's like steel and glass, and you look at another part and it's marble columns, and you know, that's the whole nature of postmodern architecture, this mixture of styles. So yes, there is the distinction, and men don't shake hands with women, and you know, all these different rules. And then at the same time, for reasons of modesty, and then you also have this concept of the whole world being an expression of godliness. So balancing that is the feat which modern Chabad tries to do in its Chabad houses, and people inspired by Chabad teaching like Matisyahu, you know, walking between the raindrops and being like a famous reggae star, and at the same time a Lubavitch Chassid, keeping all the rules of being a Lubavitch Chassid, you know, so that's the...
Well, you mean to connect between one world and the other?
Well, connecting between one world and another, and not, you know,
and living the paradox of these contradictions.
Yes, which is what being a human being is.
Yes. Celebrating the paradox.
Yeah, instead of just simplifying it by taking away all the offences.